The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Jim Cronin from the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next hour, I shall read from the Reader's Digest and Consumer Reports. But we're going to start out today with a drama in real life. And this touches home because it's about a fellow Marine. As those of you who have been listening to me for a while know, I served in the Marines for 6 years. Doctor said there was some hope for the baby born with only half a heart. But her father had just begun to fight a Marine's toughest battle. And there's a drawing showing a little tiny baby sitting in the middle of an operating table with about 6 doctors and nurses piled up around it. It seemed so real, thought Rob Velez about the dream he'd had the night before. Lying in bed after waking from a long night's sleep in his home outside London, he smiled as he remembered the wonderful scene. In it, he had been holding his newborn daughter in his strong arms. As she looked lovely into his eyes, he was so overcome with emotion that a tough 50-year-old former U.S. Marine had started crying. He was in love. He never felt this much love for anyone. Amazing, as he thought, as the morning sun streamed through his windows. This was more than a dream. He threw back his covers and put on some clothes. He had to tell his partner of 4 years, Sophia Fenrick, what he had learned from his dream. Fenrick, a 40-year-old homeopathic therapist, listened to him as he told her about his dream. "You're pregnant. We're having another baby." Fenrick laughed. They had a 2-year-old daughter, and both had 16-year-old sons from previous relationships. "No way I'm pregnant," he said. "Honey," he said, "we are having a little girl. I saw her, and she'll be beautiful." To prove it, Velez zipped downstairs to the pharmacy to get a pregnancy test kit. An hour later, 2 red lines appeared on the test strip. Fenrick was indeed pregnant. She screamed in delight and the couple embraced. "We're going to have a beautiful daughter," Velez says. "I know. I saw her last night." And there's a picture of Zoya Fenrick with her daughter Bathsheba a few days before baby Dorothea was born. She's a very pretty, attractive young lady with a gorgeous little girl. 4 months later, in February 2022, they went to the doctor's office for an ultrasound. They had held hands as the sonograph removed an electronic probe called a transducer over Fenrick's abdomen. A 2-dimensional image of their baby, whom they had already named Dorothea, appeared on the screen. They saw her tiny fingers and toes and watched as baby Dorothea, my dream daughter, came true and actually moved, Velez remembers. She was sucking her thumb. Then both of us let out a shout as it looked as she waved at us. She was so tiny, so beautiful. Suddenly the sonographer stopped moving. "We have a problem," she said. She called in a pediatric expert from a nearby hospital. An hour later, after studying the sonogram, the doctors dropped the bomb. "I'm so sorry," she said. She explained that the baby had hypoplastic left heart syndrome, HLHS, a rare, often fatal condition. Dorothea had only half a heart. The rest was undeveloped. And because of that, she had little chance of surviving. Her best advice that we elect to, and I'll never forget the word, terminate the pregnancy, says Velez, choking back tears. This was the moment that everything, our entire lives, changed forever. Never. Never. That was the word both Les and Fenrick used when they heard the doctor's advice about an abortion. "Forget about it," Les shouted at the pediatrician. After digesting the news, Dorothea's parents decided to enjoy every day they had with her. They took day trips to the seaside and visited nearby parks, where they would walk for hours to keep up steady conversation with their unborn baby, explaining what they were doing and seeing. On one trip to a botanical garden, as their 2-year-old Bathsheba screamed with joy while she chased ducklings, Fenrick caressed her own baby, Ellie, and told Dorothea, "See, your sister is having so much fun at home." Fenrick would play the piano, her son would play the violin, and Bathsheba would sing to her unborn sister. "We wanted to include Dorothea in everything," remembers Fenrick. Velez, who had been stationed in England as a Marine, had moved back there for his job with a global financial services company in 2014, was now employed at a private equity firm that worked with healthcare startups. He pulled every string he could to get a second opinion, only to hear the same diagnosis, the same suggested medical path to take: terminate the pregnancy. obsessed with saving his daughter's life, Velez quit his job and devoted all his time researching HLHS. He and Fenrick clipped into their savings to survive. He wrote countless messages to doctors, surgeons, specialists, and hospitals around the world, hoping to sign one who could help. A fetal echocardiogram at 24 weeks revealed even more bad news. In addition to HLHS, Dorothea also had a severe blockage in her heart. Their baby had only a 5% chance of survival, Velez and Fenrick were told. Then they found out about a risky in-utero-fetal operation that might be able to repair her heart. No one in the UK could carry out the complex surgery, so Velez and Fenrick looked elsewhere, eventually locating a pediatric surgeon in Texas who agreed to perform the procedure, but it would cost the couple more than $3 million. Hoping to raise the money, they started a publicity campaign, giving countless interviews to the press. Velez also sent scores of emails to celebrities, and as he remembers, every billionaire I could think of. But they raised only about $60,000, far from what they would need. As the days ticked by, their chances of saving their unborn baby's life looked more and more hopeless. Look closer! It was in the middle of the night when Velez heard the voice in his head. He was sitting alone in his home office, despairing that he'd failed his family. Am I going crazy? He thought. No, I'm hearing voices. Look closer, the voice repeated. What are you talking about? He answered out loud. I've tried everything. Look closer to home. Fine, thought Velez, I'll try again. He Googled impossible cases, miracle surgeon, UK pediatric expert in HLHS. Almost immediately, a link to a Facebook book about Guido Michelion, a cardiothoracic surgeon, popped up in the search results. Velez poured through the Facebook page, reading message after message from enthusiastic parents thanking Dr. Michelion for saving our baby's life and giving us hope and changing our lives, and even more. Even more remarkable, Velez discovered that the Italian-born surgeon was an expert in HLHS and had done more than 2,000 open-heart procedures with a special focus on neonatal surgeries. How did I miss him? Velez wondered as he wrote an email to the London-based surgeon describing Dorothea's issues and including medical notes and copies of sonograms. Within hours, he got a reply. I'm in Italy now, but I'll be back this Friday. I'm muted at the top of my appointment list. And there's a picture of Dr. Michelin, a good-looking young man. Looks like he's probably in his 40s, maybe early 50s. 5 days at the end of the long Skype conference call, Dr. Michelin gave the anxious parents the news they'd been praying for. I can help you. I will operate on Dorothea after she is born and stabilized. He explained that he hoped to basically rewire and rebuild her heart and veins several days after she was born. And instead of costing millions, the operation, called the Norwood procedure, would be fully covered by the UK's National Health Service. Phyllis and Benrick were ecstatic, but they were jolted back to reality when the surgeon warned, a child with HLHS has a very low chance of survival, and Dorothea's complications are even more severe than most. We will do our best, but please remember, the odds are not in our favor. On July 7th, at London's Royal Brompton Hospital, surrounded by a 20-strong team of medical personnel and a bank of BB blinking monitors, baby Dorothea was born by cesarean section. Velez, dressed in surgical scrubs, stood along Fenrick and peeked over the curtain to see his newborn daughter. Look, he shouted. She has a full head of hair. The team rushed Dorothea into a resuscitator unit and placed an oxygen mask on her tiny face. The priest Velez had asked to come along, hurriedly baptized her as she was being scanned. As he left the operating room, Velez noticed a group of doctors looking at a screen that showed a sonogram of Dorothea's heart. Minutes later, the chief surgeon, Alan Fraze, told Velez, I don't know how to explain this, but somehow there were 4 or 5 new veins in her heart that appeared out of nowhere. He explained that these new veins, which no one had seen on earlier scans or MRIs, were helping drain her heart. And in other words, they were keeping her alive. He sounded astonished. Dr. Michelon came out and hugged Velez. She is stable, and she is beautiful. Congratulations. The mood shifted dramatically on July 12th, when Velez and Fenrick met with Dr. Michelon and his team at the hospital to discuss the Norwood procedure operation scheduled for the next day. For less than there was something wrong. The normally ebullient physician seemed distant and didn't make eye contact. The bad news was delivered by a hospital administrator. We've decided that there is such a small chance your baby will survive this surgery that we cannot allow it to go forward. The room fell silent. Valesca could feel his own heart beating. And if she did survive, the administrator continued, there's a good chance she would suffer irreversible brain damage. Velez looked over to Dr. Mikulin for help. He was silent, looking down at the floor. The administrator said, we recommend compassionate care. You mean we should just let her die, said Velez curtly, after we've come this far? You know I want to operate, but I cannot without the support of my team, said Dr. Michelon. Velez went into a called marine mode. We're not going down like this, he told Fenric. Now, after all we've been through. He went home and sent a blistering message to the hospital CEO and the hospital attorney. One message demanded, who are you to play God? He reached out to a well-known human rights lawyer who has a successful record fighting NHS patients. Velez told Fenric that he was ready to chain himself to the Prime Minister's office on Downing Street if he had to. The pressure was on, he says. The U.S. 1st Marine Division had landed at Royal Brompton Hospital. 24 hours later, the hospital administrators related. The operation would take place. At 7:30 the next morning, Dr. Michelin, assisted by three pediatric cardiac surgeons and a team of nurses, began the delicate open-heart surgery that would reconstruct the right ventricle of Dorothea's heart so that it would pump blood to both her body and her lungs without the need of the malformed left ventricle. After Dorothea's chest was open, she was hooked up to a heart-lung machine that would temporarily take over for her heart and lungs while doctors operated on those organs. Surrounded by flickering monitors and the whirring of the heart-lung machine, Dr. Michelin began the intricate, precise procedure to build a new, larger aorta, the artery that carries blood from the heart to the rest of the body, by joining the pulmonary artery, which normally carries blood from the right ventricle to the lungs, to Dorothea's existing aorta. At less than 0.04 of an inch wide, it was unusually small. This is time-consuming, painstaking work because a baby heart is only about the size of a walnut, and Dorothea's veins and arteries were so tiny. Really a hair, says Dr. Michelin. He needed to wear high-powered magnifying glasses to see as he expertly cut and sewed her blood vessels together. The hours dragged by as the doctor and his team performed the delicate surgery. Their last step was to install a shunt from the right ventricle to the pulmonary artery, connecting in the direct flow of blood to the lungs. Nearly 11 hours after he and his team began, Dr. Michelin finally relaxed as he double-checked his work that had essentially replumbed the baby's faulty heart. By 4:30 p.m., Dr. Michelin, exhausted and still dressed in scrubs, found the parents in the waiting room. Looks good, he told them, smiling broadly. She is stabilized. The three embraced in a celebratory hug. Within minutes, Velez and Fenric were startled by a squeak of emergency alarms. A team of doctors and nurses rushed into the room where Dorothea was recovering from surgery. People screamed order. Doctors yelled, cardiac arrest! The alarm kept wailing. After a few minutes, a nurse dashed out to tell them. Dorothea's heart has stopped. Dorothea's heart has stopped. She's had a heart attack. We are trying to revive her. 10 minutes later, the returners with the same message. 15 minutes, she came back. We're still doing CPR. We are trying to get her back. An hour later, Velez and Fenric were ushered into the ICU. They were shocked to see their daughter tethered to dialysis machines and a life support unit that helped her heart pump blood. Her chest was covered with dried blood and was swollen for more than an hour of CPR procedures. She was battered and bruised, but through help of a bank of high-tech machines, she was still fighting to stay alive. Velez and Fenric reached beneath the network of tubes and lines that were keeping Dorothea alive and held her hand. When Les felt his daughter squeeze his index finger in her tiny hand, he told her, "You're a fighter. You did it. You're going to be okay." For the next 5 weeks, Velez and Fenric rarely left Dorothea's side in the ICU. They talked to her, played music for her, and caressed her. On August 26, Fenric's birthday, doctors removed Dorothea's breathing tube and took her off the ventilator, leaving her to only light-assisted breathing support from a CPAP machine. She would need a second open-heart operation in a few months, and doctors warned her parents that the next few weeks would be critical. To survive the upcoming surgery, Dorothea would have to put on weight and get stronger. The tiny girl moved out of intensive care and amazed the hospital staff by putting on more than 3 pounds in the next 2 months. Her reconstructed heart was working well, and her oxygen levels became normal. On September 14th, she was taken off the CPAP machine and began breathing on her own. On November 24th, Thanksgiving Day, Dr. Michelin performed the second surgery on her heart. He declared her prognosis excellent. She finally went home with her parents on December 21st, just in time for Christmas. She had defied the odds and lived up to her well-earned nickname, the Miracle Baby. Today, says her proud papa, she's a chubby, healthy baby and is constantly smiling and laughing. We sing happy birthday to her every morning because every day with her is a miracle. You know, right after we found out we were having a baby girl, we named her Dorothea. There was a good reason for that. He pauses and smiles as he watches Bathsheba, now 3 years old, snuggle up next to her baby sister on their living room couch. He continues, Dorothea is derived from a Greek phrase that means gift of God. And there's a picture of Bathsheba playing with Dorothea, who is looking at the camera and smiling. What a beautiful baby. The upside of anxiety. This is the health section. How to worry well. I'm an anxious traveler. I arrive at airports and train stations extra early. I trigger check all my documents and feel the tightness in my jaw, a slight clench in my stomach, until I've arrived where I'm going. Non-anxious people tease me for being a nervous Nelly. I used to feel bad about my anxiety, seeing it as irrational, weak. But not anymore. I could write a book about this subject. Actually, I did. A brief history of anxiety, yours and mine. I've learned to respect my tendency to be hypervigilant. Recently, I was driving along a country road at the start of a long trip that would mainly be on major highway. I began feeling something would go wrong. What if I run out of gas? I worried, even though I still had plenty. So when I spot a gas station just before the on-ramp I was going to take onto the highway, I gave in to my angst and decided to fill up, just in case. And that's when I discovered one of my front tires was badly deflated. If I'd overpowered my sense of unease, talked down my anxiety, the tire would have blown out at high speed on the highway. My nagging urge to plan ahead, even though it wasn't strictly necessary, saved me from a potentially catastrophic scenario. A growing number of psychologists and neuroscientists are getting out of the message that anxiety and other negative feelings have a positive role to play in our lives. Tracy Dennis Tiwari, who recently published Future Tense, Why Anxiety is Good for You, Even Though It Feels Bad, thinks our culture goes overboard on demonizing difficult emotions. She knows what it's like to get swamped from time to time by anxiety. I remember a period at work when there was a lot going on, says Dennis Tiwari, a professor of psychology and neuroscience at City University of New York's Hunter College. Worries kept waking her up at 4 a.m. It was like a yucky cloud of free-floating anxiety, she recalls, and it kept her from falling back into much-needed sleep. Instead of trying to suppress this disconcerting feeling, however, she leaned into it. If you sit with the anxiety, you have an opportunity to glean information, she says. For me, this one important ball that I had dropped at work finally rose to the surface of my mind. When I recognized this thing niggling at me and gave it space, I learned from it. I wrote down 2 or 3 things I could do to address it, and the next morning I felt calmer. Psychologist Ted Kashdan, director of the Well-Being Lab at George Mason University in Virginia and co-author of The Upside of Your Dark Side, is a critic of what he calls gung-ho happyology. We don't always have to be smiley and serene, or worries there's something wrong with us. Sometimes, he says, worry itself is what is right. Fear of heights, good, because you're not going to be Houston and falls off a cliff while taking a selfie, which unfortunately apparently just happened not too long ago. These experts wonder if the natural role that anxiety plays in our lives is somehow being forgotten. For example, the World Health Organization, WHO, announced on March 2022 that the prevalence of anxiety and depression had increased globally by 25% over the previous year. The WHO called the finding a wake-up call for all countries to step up mental health services and support. Do we know for certain that this data represents a public health crisis? Or could it mean that millions of folks are quite rightly feeling that uncertain, stressed out, and afraid? The difference is important. For instance, the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services now recommends routine screenings for anxiety by family doctors. This is a positive development, and that it recognizes the impact that anxiety disorders can have on those at risk. On the other hand, what if initiatives like this could funnel some of us into unnecessary treatments and medications? What if we lose sight of the benefits of our doubts and what-ifs? We can experience healthy, often completely valid periods of distress without being categorized as mentally ill, according to behavior psychologists. Anxiety is an adaptive strategy in human evolution. It helps us to prepare for the uncertain future, to remain vigilant, Dizdawari says. Anxiety prompts us to resolve projected unknowns by planning and imagining, by plotting out possible scenarios. From an evolutionary point of view, anxiety is the best emotion to help us manage uncertainty, she says, because it forces us to run those what-if simulations. That's what it's good for. Likewise, neuroscientist Wendy Suzuki of New York University points out in her book, Good Anxiety, Harnessing the Power of Most Misunderstood Emotion, that if we simply approach anxiety as something to avoid, get rid of or dampen, we not only don't solve the problem it's alerting us to, but we also miss an opportunity to leverage the generative power of anxiety. By generative, she means the anxiety can prompt us to move out of a situation that's no longer working, to find the energy we need to get unstuck. When we're in an anxious state, the amount of dopamine in our brains increases, which prompts us to take action. In evolutionary terms, millions of years ago, that might have meant looking for shelter to evade predatory animals. Today, it might mean leaving a job because of a predatory boss. By not faking up to our anxiety, we lose its benefits and can actually make things worse. Case in point for me, hiding unopened envelopes from the government entity I call the tax man in a drawer. Even if they could be the routine updates or reminders that self-employed people like me receive, until I've turned into a full-blown phobia. According to Alice Boyce, who has a PhD in clinical psychology and is the author of The Anxiety Toolkit, coping with unpleasant feelings by avoiding them just reinforces your insecurity because you're not getting any better at solving the problem. Over time, you feel less and less competent, she warns. The key is to manage unease before it overtakes us, like tending a garden so the weeds don't spread. How you do that, according to NYU Suzuki, solutions include meditation, exercise, compassionate connection such as volunteering, access to nature, and mentally reframing what we're experiencing. For example, in her book, Suzuki writes about a startup entrepreneur who is beginning to feel daunted by everything that could go wrong in his high-stakes venture. This generated all kinds of what-if anxiety that kept him sleepless. He was, in psychological parlance, catastrophizing. Then, after taking an old friend and mentor, he reached out for a new tool, a reframe. He turned his what-ifs into a goal directed to a to-do list. If this were to happen, then what could I do? Well, I could do X. Dizdawari agrees that reframing is crucial. She points to a Harvard study in which socially anxious people were asked to speak in public. The researchers told some of them that having sweaty palms and a dry mouth or shaky knees was a good sign, a positive coping tool that optimizes the body for performance. The nervous speaker who had heard the message had lower blood pressure and a slower heart rate. In other words, they shifted to that sweet spot where they were ready to take on the challenge, but were not distracted and alarmed by their own nervousness. That's a pretty remarkable discovery. What if it says we can reframe our fears so that they help us? Several years ago, I was the last in a long queue of speakers at a TEDx event. The theater was overly air-conditioned. I sat there shivering and going tense, worried that I would forget my speech about a book I'd recently written about the death and dying. The longer this body feedback loop of physical tension and mental anxiety went on, the worse it got, until my legs felt so rubbery I feared I would fall off the stage. It's a miracle that I made it through my talk. Knowing what I do now, I would have paced and stretched in the hallway to keep my body warmed up and my breathing calm while I waited, not unlike an athlete before an event. I still would have been nervous, but I would have been proactively managing it. One of the key problems is that our perception about anxiety stops us from believing we can manage it, says Dennis Dwary. She argues that anxiety isn't the problem. It's the messenger that tells us we are facing uncertainty and need to rise to the challenge. Or it's pointing us to ways that our life needs to change or that we need support. We can learn to manage anxiety. Suzuki's advice about how to worry well includes meditation, which has been shown to calm the amygdala, the gland in the brain responsible for sending out alarm signals related to fear and anxiety. That is such a hard word to pronounce. The exercise helps quell anxiety, too. Suzuki experimented with some of her students and found that even just a 10-minute workout could help them feel less anxious before an exam. So hit the gym, enjoy the dance floor, or go for a hike. Just spending time in natural light and green spaces, what the Japanese call forest bathing, can restore our sense of psychological balance. Since I know that humor increases oxytocin, a hormone that enhances social bonding and relatedness, I sometimes listen to stand-up comedy when I want to calm down. Social connection, touch, and a grounding perspective on others' suffering could suit too, which is why volunteering and community involvement is good for us as well as for those we help. Isolation during the pandemic may well have been a contributing factor to that uptick in anxiety noted by the WHO. These are all well-founded techniques that can keep us from spiraling. The trick, as Dennis Dwary says, is to listen to anxiety when it shows up, and then to leverage that anxiety to make needed changes or extra plans. Just as I did that day when I set off on my road trip. Then she advises, let it go. It's a wave that you'll need to learn to ride. Noodle it around. In a bizarre incident earlier this year, someone dumped an estimated 15 wheelbarrow loads of pasta near a creek in Old Bridge, New Jersey. The reason remains an unsolved mystery. That lead members of the community's Facebook had a little fun. Some residents posted a picture of a few noodles on the ground and called their rendition impostas. Another wrote, we should send the perpetrators to the state penitentiary. Well, with that story being over, let's go ahead and switch over to Consumer Reports. Last week, we read an article about how to stay healthy longer, and there were a couple items we hadn't finished yet. And one is the truth about 4 anti-aging pills. It was all like to find that magic pill where we don't get older, don't feel worse, and have more energy all the time, says Ann Arcopola, MD, a professor of medicine at the University of Pennsylvania's Perelman School of Medicine. Could these substances have potentials? Aspirin. This over-the-counter pain pill has long been used to lower heart attack and stroke risks, but regular use can cause side effects like bleeding. People with cardiovascular disease, CVD, especially those who've already had a heart attack or stroke, should continue to use a daily low dose. But experts say some 40 to 59-year-olds without CVD may see only a small benefit, so they should talk with their doctors. People 60 and up with no CVD shouldn't start aspirin because the bleeding risk outweighs the benefits. Metformin. This prescription drug for type 2 diabetes is linked to a reduced incidence of cancer, improved heart health, and some cognitive protection in animal studies. It appears to extend lifespan and health span. Researchers are exploring whether it might do the same for people, but they don't know if the long-term use is healthy for everyone or how to reduce side effects such as diarrhea. Prevagen. This supplement is widely marketed as a memory booster, but some doctors say it's overhyped and unproven. Its makers have settled several lawsuits regarding their marketing assertions, and in an ongoing government case, they've been charged with making deceptive health claims, as with other supplements like Focus Factor and Nervia. Prevagen's makers do not have to prove its efficacy and safety before putting it on the market. Rapamycin. Discovered in Easter Island soil, this molecule is now a prescription drug given to kidney transplant patients. Rapamycin appears to activate the same pathways as calorie restriction, which extends life in animal studies. Early evidence suggests that it may help prevent some cancers and improve cardiovascular function, at least in mice, but its immune-suppressing effects may weaken your defenses against infection. Your skin. What happens as you age? Signs of aging often first appear under the eyes, as people lose collagen and the skin thins, says Karen Grossman, MD, a dermatologist in Santa Monica, California, and New York City, fine lines and wrinkles start to appear. As decades go on, these lines deepen, and people lose the fat beneath the skin, which can lead to sagging. Skin spots, including boles and freckles, as well as brown age spots, may appear. Much of what people tend to think of as old-looking skin are people who have photo sun damage to skin, Grossman says. In older adults, itchiness and bruises can also become more common, and wounds heal more slowly. Key signs of trouble. Melanoma, the most potentially fatal form of skin cancer, represents 5% of all new cancer cases each year. So see your doctor if you notice new or changing moles, or those with their regular, uneven, or asymmetrical borders. Do the same if a wound seems infected or isn't healing after about a week. What can help? The most important thing you can do is use sunscreen, Grossman says. Everybody of all skin colors should be wearing a minimum of SPF 30 every day on all sun-exposed areas, he says. This includes older adults who often don't use sufficient sun protection, according to the CDC. Certain products can mitigate or even reverse signs of skin aging, Grossman says. Research has found that over-the-counter topicals with retinoids, use them at night, can spur the growth of new skin cells and boost collagen to help reduce skin thinning, fine lines, and wrinkles, she says. Preliminary evidence indicates that collagen supplements may reduce sagginess, and a scent-free daily moisturizer with ingredients such as hyaluronic acid, lanolin, and shea butter can soothe skin itchiness. Grossman says she's noticing young people with horizontal necklines, thanks to time spent staring down at mobile phone and laptop screens. So watch your posture while using devices. An eye-level computer monitor may help. Also, keep in mind that aside from checking concerning moles, dermatologists often offer treatments on a wide variety of skin issues that might cause you discomfort. Well, this next article is a cool thing, which, pun intended, which milk should you drink? Lactose-free, A2, oat, coconut, even cashew. There are more new milks on the market than ever. What tastes great and is good for you, too? Read on. It used to be that milk was one of the most straightforward drinks out there. You could choose whole, low-fat, or skim, and that was it. But over the past 10 to 15 years, the milk aisle has gotten considerably more crowded with a mind-boggling variety of dairy milks, A2, grass-fed, ultra-filtered, and plant milks, oat, almond, sesame seed, etc. According to a 2023 Consumer Reports National Representative Survey of 2121 U.S. adults, 79% still buy cow's milk. However, people are drinking a lot less of it. Per capita consumption has declined by 28% in the past 20 years or so, from 8.2 gallons per person per year in 2000 to 5.9 gallons in 2021, according to the Department of Agriculture. At the same time, sales of plant-based milk have been increased. In 2022, 41% of households had purchased plant milks, according to a market analysis by Plant-Based Food Association. Of all the milk sold, 15% is now plant milk, the report said. To keep up with growing plant milk market, the dairy industry has prompted what it claims are healthier and more sustainable cow's milk options. Meanwhile, on the plant milk side, more choices with added nutrients and better taste have made going dairy-free more appealing. Is cow's milk good for you? There's a lot of conflicting information about dairy milk floating around. It has been positioned by some as a near-perfect food, necessary for bone health. But others say it is a cause of everything from inflammation and heart disease to digestive disorders and bad skin. The truth is, cow's milk has mostly benefits and just a few drawbacks. On the plus side, it is a concentrated source of important nutrients. One cup supplies 8 grams of protein, about a quarter of the daily value for calcium, and 14% of the daily value of vitamin D, and provides magnesium, potassium, zinc, and more. There has been concern that the structured fat, saturated fats in dairy milk, except for the non-fat variety, can lead to chronic inflammation, which is thought to be a root cause of type 2 diabetes and other health problems. But a 2017 review of 52 studies in the Journal of Critical Reviews in Food Science and Nutrition linked milk and other dairy consumption with anti-inflammatory effects in adults. Similarly, having a cup of milk a day doesn't increase or reduce the risk of heart disease. A 2022 analysis of studies in the Journal of Nutrients concluded Drinking a lot of milk, however, may contribute to acne, according to some studies, but others find no connection. One thing about cow's milk that is clear, many adults experience bloating, gas, and other stomach problems when they drink it. That's because they're unable to digest lactose, the sugar that naturally occurs in milk. For these people, lactose-free milk is widely available. Unless milk upsets your stomach, there's no reason, health reason, to skip it. But it's also fine for someone who eats a healthy variety of foods to avoid milk, says Christopher Gardner, PhD in nutrition and scientist at Stanford University in California. Yogurt, kefir, and cheese are excellent sources of all milk's nutrients. There are non-dairy options such as tahini, collard greens, kale, and bok choy for calcium, lean meats, beans, and tofu for protein, and canned salmon and sardines for both. The lowdown on plant milks. Almost half the people who buy plant-based milk do so because they think it's healthier or has more nutrients they need than cow's milk, and 35% think it's better for the environment or to protect animals, according to CR survey. But many experts say that plant-based milks are not more helpful than dairy milk. Soy milk comes at the closest to dairy as long as it's fortified with calcium and vitamin D. But most other plant-based products do not contain nutrients comparable to dairy milk, says Emma Lang, PhD, Director of Dietetics at the University of Georgia in Athens. So if you're switching to plant milk and you relied on your daily cup of dairy milk for protein, calcium, and vitamin D, you need to be sure you're getting them elsewhere. On one other issue with plant milks, some may contain additives like sweeteners and thickeners. Unless you seek out unsweetened varieties, you may be getting as much as 13 grams of added sugars per cup. The American Heart Association says men should have no more than 36 grams per day, and women 25. And thickeners and stabilizers, the carrageenan, xanthate gum, and guar gum, which help give plant milks a consistency like dairy milk, may be problematic for certain people. Some studies have shown an adverse association between these additives and inflammation in the GI tract, Lang says. If you notice gastrointestinal discomfort after drinking a plant-based milk, try additive-free options such as those made by Elmhurst and Malik. Plant milks do have an edge when it comes to sustainability. Their production creates 62 to 78% less greenhouse gases than dairy milk and uses less water and land resources. A 2023 report in the journal Current Environmental Health Report says, but not all plant milks are equally environmentally friendly. According to a 2022 study published in the Journal of Sustainability, oat and soy milks are the best for the planet. Dairy choices. Here's what to know about the cow's milk on the market. Number one, grass-fed. Cows that graze exclusively on grass produce milk that has more heart-healthy omega-3 fatty acids than regular milk. But you'd have to drink about 3 cups of whole milk to get just 19% of a man's daily needs, 27% for women. So it shouldn't be your only source. Grass-fed milk can have an earthy flavor. It's also pricey. A half gallon of organic grass-fed at Target costs $6.49 compared with $3.99 for regular organic. Look for the American Grass-Fed Seal, which CR considers to have excellent standards. Ultra-filtered. An extra processing step filters out some water and some of the lactose. This concentrates the milk, making it higher in protein and lower in sugar, and gives it a thicker, creamier texture. Companies add lactose. Also add lactose, the enzyme that breaks down any remaining lactose. I'm sorry, lactase, the enzyme that breaks down any remaining lactose into simple sugars. The difference there is instead of an A for lactase and an O for lactose. Kind of hard to tell the difference in print. A step that creates a sweeter flavor than regular milk, because it's thicker than regular milk. Because it's thicker than regular milk, it may not work as a one-to-one swap in recipes. At Walmart, a 52-ounce carton costs just $4.18. 64 ounces of regular milk costs $1.73. Ultra-pasteurized. Typically, this process is used on organic milk to extend its shelf life. The milk is heated to a higher temperature during pasteurization than regular milk. This kills more of the bacteria that can make milk spoil. Regular pasteurization mainly kills bacteria that can cause illness. Once you open the carton, though, you should still consume it within 7 to 10 days like any other milk. As for nutrition, it's no different from regular dairy milk, but some complain that it has a cooked flavor. Lactose-free. If your body doesn't produce enough lactose, the enzyme that breaks down the lactose in milk, you may experience bloating, gas, and diarrhea when you drink dairy milk. Lactose-free milk has lactase added, so it's easier to digest for those who are lactose intolerant. It has the same nutrients as regular milk, but it tastes a little sweeter. Use it like regular milk, but you might not need to add any sugar to your coffee. A2. People often assume that the only stomach upset after drinking milk is due to lactose intolerance. But a lactose-free milk still bothers your belly. You may want to try A2 milk. Regular milk contains A1 and A2 proteins. A1 has been linked with GI symptoms and inflammation in some people. A2 milk comes from cows that don't produce the A1 protein, so it can be easier to digest. A2 milk still contains lactose, so it won't help those with lactose intolerance, but it also costs more. At Shaw's, 59 ounces is $4.99, while 64 ounces of regular milk is $2.69. Skim versus whole, which is healthier? For the past few decades, doctors and dietitians have advised that non-fat or low-fat dairy is the way to go to cut back on calories and saturated fat, which experts thought would raise cholesterol levels, upping their risk of heart disease. Newer studies, however, call these beliefs into question. Current research indicates that the fats in milk are not associated with weight gain, type 2 diabetes, heart disease, or inflammation, says Beth Bradley, Ph.D., a lecturer in the Department of Nutrition and Food Sciences at the University of Vermont. Any milk consumption as part of an overall healthy eating pattern is just fine, she says. If you enjoy non-fat or low-fat milk, stick with it. Replacing one cup of whole milk with non-fat in your smoothie, for example, can save you about 60 calories and 4 grams of saturated fat without cutting protein or calcium. Getting real about raw. Most milk in this country goes through the process of pasteurization. That means it has been heated to a temperature that's high enough to kill harmful, potentially deadly bacteria, such as Campylobacter E, E. coli, Salmonella, and more. Milk that has not gone through this process is considered raw. Proponents of raw milk claim that pasteurization limits milk's nutrients. There's no evidence, however, to prove this. And raw milk and cheese is responsible for 96% of dairy-related foodborne illness and hospitalizations that occur each year in the U.S., according to the research published in the Journal of Emerging Infectious Diseases, despite the fact that only 3.2% of Americans drink raw milk. It's often better to choose foods that are less processed, fresh vegetables instead of veggie chips, for example. But for some foods, processing represents a major food safety advance. Pasteurized milk falls squarely into that category. Plant picks. Read on for the healthiest, tastiest options. Number one, soy. Among all plant milks, soy contains the most protein, vitamins, and minerals, coming to the closest dairy milk in nutritional value. And when the Food and Drug Administration researchers analyzed 85 plant-based milk samples, soy milk stood out for being high in several minerals found in dairy milk. Soy milk has a slightly sweet, nutty flavor that can work well in coffee, with cereal, or for drinking. Number two, oat milk. Oat milk's mildly sweet flavor, thickness, and natural creaminess make it a good substitute for dairy in soups, coffee drinks, and baking. It's higher in carbs than dairy milk and most other plant-based milks, supplying as much as 17 grams per cup of unsweetened versions. Dairy milk has 12 grams per cup. Coconut. Coconut milk has more saturated fat than other plant-based milks, and about the same amount as whole cow's milk. But some of those fats are medium-chain fatty acids, which don't seem to be linked to heart disease. Its taste is mild with a slightly tropical twist. Just make sure you're buying coconut milk in a carton rather than canned. The canned type is thicker, higher in fat, and better used in cooking than as a drink. Almond milk. Slightly sweet, nutty almond milk is widely available. It tends to be lower in calories than most other plant-based milk. It's not as eco-friendly as other plant-based milk because it takes a lot more water, even more than dairy milk, to produce. Perfect for smoothie, its mild flavors let other ingredients shine. Number 5, cashew milk. This milk has an earthier, richer flavor and thicker texture than some other plant-based options. Used in soups, sauces, and other recipes, you might use cream in. It's also an easy plant-based milk to make at home. Soak one cup of raw cashews in water overnight and drain. Combine in a blender with 4 cups of water and a pinch of salt, Add vanilla or a date to sweeten if desired. Sesame seed, number 6. This milk has a toasty flavor and a nutrition profile similar to other milks. Some options contain up to 8 grams of protein, but it's not all naturally found in the milk. Rather, it's added pea protein. Because it's newer to the market, you may have a hard time finding sesame milk at local stores. The sesame plant doesn't require a lot of water to grow and is naturally heat resistant, so it's a good bet for sustainability. Pairs well with cereal and fruit. What's really in that plant milk? There's no best plant milk, but how do you know if the plant-based milk you've been buying is best for you? It depends on what is affordable, satisfied your taste, quenches your thirst, and has key components that provide energy and nutrients to support your health, says dietitian Emma Lang, PhD. To learn more about nutrition, look past the trendy marketing and colorful designs to lead the nutrition fact label, she says. Here's what to consider. Calcium. Choosing plant milk instead of dairy can mean you've lost one of your diet's top sources of calcium. Plant-based milks don't contain much calcium naturally. If your diet doesn't have other calcium sources, look to a plant milk fortified with at least 300 milligrams, roughly the same amount as you get a cup in the dairy milk. You can also talk to your doctor or dietitian about other ways to meet your calcium needs. Protein. A cup of cow's milk has 8 grams of satisfying protein. Many plant-based milks will have only around 1 gram per cup, unless they're fortified with isolated protein, which is a highly processed ingredient. That said, there's a lot of variety among brands, so be sure to check labels. Elmer's unsweetened milk almonds, for example, has 5 grams, all from almonds. The company uses more nuts per serving than any other brand. And soy milk is the one consistent exception, with almost the same amount of naturally occurring protein per cup as dairy milk. Vitamin D. Most of the dairy milk in the U.S. is fortified with about 3 micrograms per cup, making it an important source of the nutrient. The daily value is 20 micrograms. If you're opting for plant-based milk, look for one fortified with about the same amount. Get the insurance you need at a great price. When was the last time you took a good look at your auto insurance or consider whether your homeowner's policy provides enough coverage? If you have no idea, it's been more than a couple of years, and now is an excellent time. Experts recommend that everyone do an insurance checkup once every year or two. But if you recently retired or your lifestyle is otherwise shifting, say your kids graduated college, you're launching a home-based business, or you plan to travel more, it's especially important to make sure your coverage suits you. Milestone moments in life are useful reminders that your insurance needs may be changing, says Doug Heller, Director of Consumer of Insurance at the Consumer Federation of America. People who are thinking about retirement should be asking both if the suite of insurance products they have fits their current circumstances and if the market can provide better alternatives. This could be a smart time to add some coverage. Perhaps you build up a sizable retirement nest egg, for example, and want to be sure it's protected in the event you get sued for more than the current liabilities on your home or auto insurance policies. On the other hand, you may find that you can reduce your coverage and save some money if, say, you're driving less or no longer need to cover your kids on your auto policy. Here, we'll walk you through the most common reasons to evaluate the insurance policy you already have and a few other types of coverage that may be worth considering, plus some that are probably not. Review the policies you already have. Auto insurance. If you're driving less than you used to, your car is paid off or getting old, your children no longer live at home or drive your car, your assets have grown and need to be protected. Consider these changes. Because older drivers tend to drive less and more safely, many auto insurance offer discounts to people in their 50s and early 60s. A few years later, however, the actuarial table will start tilting the other way, even to those with good driving records. Rates typically inch up around age 65 and jump dramatically at around 80. Wherever you are on the age continuum, ask your carrier for discounts, especially if you're not commuting to work as often or stop driving to a job altogether. Less driving should translate into lower premiums. It may also pay to simply shop around. The reward for being a loyal customer is often not enough to compete with other offerings on the market, and some insurers even charge higher rates to longtime customers because the company doesn't expect them to shop around. Consider, too, whether you need to continue to cover your children. You can get a discount if they're away at college without a car, and you'll save more by dropping them from your policy altogether. If your car is getting old, you can save by dropping collision component of your coverage, which pays for cash-related repairs to your vehicle. As the car's value declines, you could end up spending more on premiums than it would cost to restore the car after an accident. A good guideline, according to Heller, consider dropping collision coverage if the annual premium exceeds 10% of the car's value. Another cost-saving strategy is to raise the deductible on the comprehensive and or collision components. Going from $200 to $500 saves 15 to 30% off the premiums, and as much as 40% if you raise the deductible to $1,000. Just be sure you have enough emergency cash on hand so that higher deductibles won't bust your budget. Finally, you can save at least 5% on your auto policy by bundling, that is, buying your home, auto, and possibly other types of insurance from the same company. Just keep in mind that a discount on one company's rates doesn't necessarily beat another company's prices, so make sure to shop around. Is there ever a case for increasing your auto coverage at this time in your life? Yes. If you've amassed substantial savings and are not carrying enough liability coverage to protect if you were to cause a catastrophic crash and get sued, the minimum liability coverage required in many states is likely to be inadequate. That said, a most cost-effective way to ensure your assets are protected from liability claims will often be to supplement auto and home policies with so-called umbrella insurance. Home insurance. Review if you recently bought a new home or fixed up your current one. You plan to be away from home for long stretches. You started a home-based business. You got a new dog. Your home or belongings have increased in value. Consider these changes. Let's start with what not to do. Because mortgage providers require borrowers to carry homeowners insurance and often build the premiums into the monthly payments, you might think you can let it lapse once you pay off your mortgage. Wrong. In fact, even if you paid off your mortgage, you may need more home coverage than in the past. For example, if you made home improvements, spiffed up the kitchen, added a room, or installed accessibility features like ramps, you should ask your carrier for a post-renovation evaluation to ensure it will all be replaced if catastrophe strikes. And as with auto insurance, the liability protection on your home policy should be enough to protect your net worth if someone gets injured on your property and sues you. Though again, supplementing home insurance with an umbrella policy may be the best option. Raising home values and inflation are also reasons to consider increasing your coverage, or at least asking your carrier to assess the current replacement value. Over time, you may have collected art, jewelry, or memorabilia that would not necessarily be covered by the home policy you put in place decades earlier. You should document them and alert your carrier, says a certified financial planner, James Lee, president of Financial Planning Association. Some carriers may require adding special provisions or riders to the policy, he says. If you're moving out of your home for an extended period of time, to winter in a warmer climate, for example, tell your carrier, says Bernie Birnbaum, director of the Center for Economic Justice and Consumer Representatives at the National Association of Insurance Commissioners. Many policies will not cover damage that occurs while property is vacant. A home-based business is another reason to alert your carrier, especially if you see clients or store equipment at home. If a customer gets hurt or a tool causes some damage, a typical homeowner's policy may not cover that, Birnbaum says. Another issue is your pet. If your dog bites someone, most homeowners' policies cover you up to the liability limit. But double check. Some companies in some states exclude certain breeds deemed dangerous. All that said, there are ways to reduce your homeowner's insurance cost. Some carriers offer discounts if you install security systems, smoke detectors, and loss mitigation devices such as water leak and gas sensors. Also, note that your home policy doesn't need to cover your property's full market value, just its replacement value, which is typically lower because your land would generally retain its value in the event of a catastrophic fire, for example. Finally, as with auto insurance, you can lower your premiums by raising your deductible, bumping it from $1,000 to $2,500 will reduce your premium by an average of 11%, according to the Insurance Information Institute. Again, be sure a higher deductible won't bust your budget. Life insurance. Review if you have retired or bring in less money than you used to, and your term life policy expired. It's particularly important to reevaluate your life insurance as you approach early retirement. Your life insurance needs are probably different than they were when you first bought the policy, says Dan McDonald, who advises financial planners on life insurance. Life insurance is typically purchased to replace income if a family's earner dies, so that you continue to cover major expenses like your mortgage or a child's education. So if those expenses have already been covered, it may be sensible to consider dropping your life insurance policy. On the other hand, if you have a special needs child who require financial support long-term after you or your spouse dies, that's a reason to consider maintaining a life insurance policy. If you decide you want to drop, reduce, or reduce your life insurance coverage, the advice depends on which kind of life insurance you have, term or permanent. With a term policy, it provides a level death benefit for a fixed premium for a limited amount of time, typically 10 to 20 years, but builds no cash value over time. You simply cancel the policy. The calculus is more complicated if you have a permanent life insurance policy, such as whole, universal, or variable life. These policies have an investment component and typically have built-up cash value that can be accessed in a number of ways. Even if you want to stop paying the premium, if you need the funds to help finance your retirement, you might choose to cash out the policy. If you hope to reduce your monthly expenses but still maintain some life insurance coverage, you could accept a reduced death benefit in exchange for smaller or no premiums. This typically wipes out the cash value of your policy. You may even be able to convert a whole life policy to term life. All these options have significant and sometimes hidden costs as well as potential benefits. Permanent life insurance policies are notoriously complex and fee-laden, which is why many consumer advocates steer people away from them and toward plain vanilla term policies. And the life insurance industry is rife with conflicts of interest. So any decision should be made with a financial advisor who can help you understand all your options and how they'd fit into your broader financial plan. The advisor should be a fiduciary, someone legally obligated to work in your best interests, and fee only, that is paid directly by you for objective advice rather than by insurance company to sell the most profitable products for it. And with that, we have just about run out of time for today's episode of Reader's Digest and Consumer Reports. Be sure to listen in next time. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. This broadcast is readily available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call us at 919-832-5138. That's 919-832-5138. I'm Jim Cronin, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. So long until next week, and thank you again so much for listening.